just from the south-southeast now at 9 miles per hour. Temperature's been holding at 62 degrees throughout the morning. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Now 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Because PBS has been airing the Ken Burns documentary series about the Vietnam War, we've been going into the Morning Show archives and replaying some past programs, examining various facets of the conflict and its aftermath. On today's program, you will hear the second of two interviews I was privileged to conduct with Lewis Sorley, talking about his remarkable book, A Better War, The Unexamined Victories and Final Tragedy of America's Last Years in Vietnam. The book examines America's military efforts in Vietnam from 1968 onward. 1968 was the year when control of our military forces in Vietnam was shifted from General William Westmoreland to General Creighton Abrams. And because our first conversation simply could not cover all that was in this book, I asked Mr. Sorley if we could have a follow-up conversation, and he very kindly agreed to do so. So that second interview is what you will be hearing today. Lewis Sorley, a third-generation graduate of West Point and proud U.S. Army veteran, also served on the staff at the Pentagon. He has written a number of different books about the Vietnam War. This one, again, is called A Better War, The Unexamined Victories and Final Tragedy of America's Last Years in Vietnam, published by Harvest, which is a division of Harcourt. For as thorough as our conversation was that aired yesterday, by no means were we able to explore everything of interest and significance in your book. There are a few things I want to touch upon that we did not get to. One of the things that I found especially interesting is a story that you tell about actually a visit which Vice President Spiro Agnew made to Vietnam when he met with General Creighton Abrams, among others. And Abrams, in describing how the war was at that time being waged and the particular challenges the Americans were facing and the South Vietnamese, drew upon a fascinating analogy that I think will be of great surprise to many listeners. He likened the waging of this war to an orchestra. Can you explain a little further about this analogy? I think it tells us so much about General Abrams, but also tells us something about war.
That's the way I feel about it, too. General Abrams was quite a remarkable man, and I've been studying him and writing about him and talking about him and interviewing other people about him for more than two decades now. I feel I know him pretty well, even though I only had three brief encounters with him in his lifetime. Among other things, he was a devotee of classical music, and he had an enormous collection of such music. This is in the days before the wonderful CDs and the ways that we now keep our music and listen to it. While he commanded in Vietnam, he was there for 4 years, as we discussed before, plus a year earlier as the deputy. He had a particular music store in Philadelphia that would send him new classical recordings at his request. And as soon as he received them, they'd come on vinyl, I guess probably a 33 and a third at that point, RPM. He'd put them on tape so he could preserve them, because, you know, the weather out in Vietnam was harsh on things like vinyl. and he'd play them, and people would say he'd play them at a very high volume. And one staff officer who had to go over and see him in his quarters one time on some item of business after duty hours came away, and he said the music was played so loud his face hurt when he was talking to Abrams. But Abrams was very admiring of the art of conductorship, if we could call it that. And he used to talk about how a symphony conductor calls for just a little bit of brass, a little bit of timpani, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and he calls for it at just the right time. And the key is integrating all those different instruments. In other words, if you want to put it this way, all these different capabilities. And then he would describe how a commander, a military commander, has the responsibility for doing a very similar thing, integrating his ground forces and his artillery support and his close air support and the helicopter gunships and the medical evacuation helicopters and all those things. And the art is in getting them to all work together, not interfere with one another. And then he would say to his commanders, trying to get them to be circumspect in the use of military force when they are operating adjacent to civilian populations, to the innocents that they're trying to help. He said, you know, yes, bring in some artillery fire, but don't bring in a whole hour of artillery fire. You know, it's like a little bit of timpani at just at the right time, and not the whole orchestra being overwhelmed by the timpani. So he was very good about that, and you know, even as you brought up that conversation with Spiro Agnew, who probably knew very little about military affairs, it's an analogy that's easy to understand. And so he was able to communicate quite well using that, but it came out of his love for classical music and his understanding of what a conductor was trying to do.
And it's so intriguing because it brings to the front the idea of nuance,
yes.
of sort of subtle nuance. And
absolutely.
And of course, most of us who really have nothing to do with the military life or know nothing really about the intricacies of enormous military undertakings, that's the last adjective we would ever use to describe it. And indeed, there are probably have been certain kinds of warfare that were not especially nuanced. But there was something about this Vietnamese conflict, the setting and so on, and the circumstances, where it was probably, in your estimation, even more important to think of the waging of this war in that kind of way.
Absolutely. If you permit me, I'll just add two short footnotes to what we've been discussing. I might have said this in our earlier conversation, so I'll make it brief, but At one point, General Abrams said, "My problem is colored blue," and blue meant he was referring to his own friendly forces, which are usually shown in battle maps in blue as compared to the enemy shown in red. And by that, he meant it reining in the excess use of military force in circumstances where that was going to spill over onto the civilian population and harm, damage the very people that they were trying to protect. And by the way, losing their goodwill in the process. So he found it very important to try to coach his subordinates in that. At one point, he cranked up a study that came to be called "Where Shall We Let Peace Come to Vietnam?" And it was on the same issue. And they began by talking about the use of artillery, and then they expanded it to the use of close air support. And he sent away a brilliant young captain got this job, and he went away and studied various campaigns or battles, and he came back with examples, and then they would be briefed to the staff and so on, and there was further discussion. And finally, this young officer came back, and he said, "Sir," he said, I can't seem to find any more examples." And the reason was, of course, the commanders were listening to all this, and they saw what Abrams wanted, and they understood it. And so they themselves reined back the excessive use of force, and the young captain ran out of things to study. So I thought that was very important. The other footnote is this. If you're talking about counterinsurgency and the way that it was waged under Creighton Abrams and Ambassador Ellsworth Bunker and William Colby, about whom we spoke earlier, it consisted of a whole panoply of things, like a whole orchestra of different instruments and capabilities, let's say. And Abrams' view was that the military force was maybe the least of these. I think I said before that he told a group of American ambassadors from the region, in the whole sweep of this war, the battles don't really mean very much. That's a radical departure from how things were conducted under his predecessor.
And particularly radical for a general to be saying that.
Well, that's true, but he understood that the health and ability of local governments and the improvement of the economy and especially the security for the people, so they could go about their lives without being constantly threatened by action from the enemy, were important constituents of a counterinsurgency war. And, you know, I think we touched on this a little bit earlier too, but those were things that it was hard for the media to see. And so those were underreported or even unreported aspects of the war, but which were crucially important to why it became a better war.
Another metaphor which is utilized by Abrams is not at all that of a symphony orchestra, but it also speaks, I think, so clearly to some of what he was encountering and struggling with. In a discussion with his field commanders, the metaphor was brought up of a baseball game, but a baseball game in which there were more than just the players on the field. Can you describe, first of all, to our listeners, this metaphor and the reality which it was, in fact, describing all too well?
I'd be glad to do that, and I want to say I very much appreciate the things you're singling out here because they're centrally important to the story of the book. Abrams was, I'll say maybe this is too strong, but the victim of a very convoluted chain of command and a very convoluted governmental situation in Washington during the years that he commanded in Vietnam. The president, of course, was Richard Nixon, and the Secretary of Defense was Melvin Laird, and Henry Kissinger was in the White House exercising considerable authority and influence, and messages would come out from the White House or from the Pentagon, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or through the diplomatic channels to Ambassador Bunker, and often they would be giving conflicting guidance. And Ambassador Bunker and General Abrams had a wonderfully fine, close, and relationship of mutual respect. And Abrams would tell senior officers coming out to work out there, if you can't get along with the ambassador, there's no point in your being here. And he would, if any had not heeded that advice, I'm sure he would have sent him home. But he and Bunker were very close. And so they would try to work out these differing sets of guidance they'd receive and so on. But in trying to describe this once, he said, yeah, well, it's like a baseball game, but it's not any baseball game that that we've ever seen, because baseball, as everyone who likes it knows, is a game very much played by the rules. And the rules were abandoned in the baseball game they used to describe what it was like to try to command in Vietnam under these circumstances. They'd say the crowd is on the field, the reporters are on the field, and the umpires have abandoned the game and gone into the locker room, and it's essentially, of course, they were saying it was chaos. So, and meanwhile, back in Washington, you could argue that similar chaos prevailed, because on some occasions, Mr. Nixon would try to deal with field commanders without the Secretary of Defense, Melvin Laird, knowing what was going on. And this particularly got to be the case when the withdrawals of American forces began. As we discussed earlier, during the entirety of Abrams' tenure, there were never any additional forces sent, nor did he ever ask for any, and the forces that he had were progressively withdrawn in 14 increments. And Laird was always pushing for a faster withdrawal pace, and Nixon was resisting that to some degree, maybe encouraged in that by Kissinger. And the people in Vietnam, of course, are trying to answer the mail and deal with all the various constituencies who are exerting some authority over them, meanwhile trying not to abandon the poor South Vietnamese, but to help them get better prepared for when all the Americans were gone. It was quite a challenging circumstance.
And, of course, at the heart of all of that is this notion that this was a different kind of war, and there were all kinds of very important people who seemed not to fully grasp that. You quote at one point Ambassador Bunker saying, "I think in the beginning one of the problems and one of the difficulties we had was that we really didn't quite understand the nature of the war, that it was a war new to the Americans' experience. And I think we had the feeling in the very beginning, before General Abrams got there, that it wasn't going to be as serious a war as it turned out to be."
Yes.
You are speaking about this, that is quoting Ambassador Bunker, in the midst of a discussion about something called Vietnamization.
Yes.
Which you say was actually quite an awkward term, and one which the Vietnamese themselves, to some extent, really resented. But it was one important reality, which proved to be a source of some complication and difficulty. Explain to our listeners what the term Vietnamization meant.
Well, I do think it's an awkward term, and its origins are a little bit contentious. No one can say for sure, but they took the word Vietnam and they said, okay, we're going to Vietnamize the war, so this becomes Vietnamization. And what it meant was progressively turning back the conduct of the war to the Vietnamese in its entirety.
They'd and getting ourselves out of it.
That's right. And the Vietnamese had obviously been involved from the beginning and were going to be involved until the end. And one of the senior Marine officers in the Vietnamese Armed Forces said, you know, I don't really know what this means. I've been here fighting the war all right along. It's been pretty Vietnamized as far as I'm concerned. But that was a term to describe the handing over of the responsibility as American forces were progressively withdrawn. But as we've been discussing, and I'm very happy that we have been talking about in these broad gauge terms, that meant much more than just handing over the military responsibilities as we withdrew our military forces. Because if the enterprise was going to succeed, and as you know, I have argued that it did succeed, that the war was won at a given point, even though the fighting hadn't ended, because we had enabled the South Vietnamese if we'd kept our commitments to them, to sustain themselves in their independence, even though we'd withdrawn our forces. So that involved some of the many of the other things we've been talking about, the strengthening of the economy, the strengthening of local government, the improvement and expansion and better arming of the armed forces, with special emphasis on the regional and popular forces, which were the ones located permanently in their in or near their homes and their families and their ancestral grave sites and the other things they held most dear. And those became the hold in the clear and hold strategy which General Abrams instituted in contrast to the search and destroy strategy that General Westmoreland had used before, tactics that he'd used before. And so things went much better because of that fundamental thing that you alluded to, which is a different understanding of the nature of the war. And basically that was an understanding that it was a war that had many aspects, and only a few of those aspects were military, and those were maybe not even the most important. Everyone agreed that the first requirement for for a successful pacification was security, and so that was not in contention, except as to how that security should be provided. And Abrams changed the tactics in ways I've described, but then the understanding of the complex nature of the war and the comprehensive nature of it was, I think, what allowed Ambassador Bunker and William Colby and General Abrams to enable the South Vietnamese to succeed. We've got to remember, it was not us who succeeded. It was them who succeeded with our enormous help, of course. But ultimately, they had to do so. Abrams said at one point, you know, sooner or later, the Vietnamese have to win this thing for themselves. He said, we can only help, and we can only help so much.
Hmm. And, of course, one of the things which proved to be of crucial importance is that ultimately the Vietnam conflict became so politically unsavory that the support that we had promised to give to the South Vietnamese in their efforts against the North Vietnamese being supported by the Soviets and the Chinese, that support promised, in fact, was not fully delivered. Explain to what extent, in fact, that was true, that we did not fulfill the promises we had made to the South Vietnamese.
Well, it was progressively became a greater and greater extent. And to me, one of the really saddest aspects of this is, you know that I was there as a soldier, and of course, so many of my friends were also, and we sacrificed 58,000 plus lives in our efforts to help the South Vietnamese. And at the end, when the Congress of the United States decided to abandon South Vietnam, the only thing we were giving them then was money and logistical support. You know, we'd gotten our prisoners back, we'd withdrawn all our forces, and the money was inconsequential as compared to what we had invested in that war. So I thought that was a terribly sad thing done to not only the South Vietnamese, but to those of us who had given important parts of our lives and sometimes even given our lives in an effort to help South Vietnam remain free.
And you help us appreciate some of the specific numbers in reminding us that the early 1970s was a period of very serious inflation, so that when we see some of these numbers coming down in terms of financial support given to South Vietnam, I mean, amount of support dramatically less than had initially been promised. The fact that on top of that, we're talking about inflation, which depleted the value of those dollars still further, that meant that even more than the raw numbers would indicate, we were pulling back our support drastically.
That's very true, and the period that we're talking about is, let's say, late 1972 through the end of the war at the end of April 1975. And as you may recall, that in 1973 we had this worldwide crisis because of the oil embargoes that were put into effect by OPEC. And then the result was that the oil prices escalated greatly, and we began to do unkind, I don't know what else to call it, unkind things to the South Vietnamese, such as charge them more for the shipping of the wherewithal that we sent to them, and made it just extremely difficult for them. And we had, in my view, we had every reason to want to do everything we could to help them succeed then, because Mr. Nixon's policy had pretty well succeeded. He had progressively withdrawn our forces to pacify the anti-war elements in our country, but the progressive withdrawal had permitted the South Vietnamese, with our help, to build up the capability to replace the forces that we'd withdrawn, and they were not in bad shape in late 1972. They had sustained a major enemy offensive of perhaps 20 division equivalents across the DMZ at Easter of 1972, and with great valor and loss, thrown the enemy back with our help, but only our help of air power and naval gunfire, because the ground forces had been withdrawn. And they inflicted such losses on the enemy that it was three more years before they could mount major offensive. And so had we sustained the Vietnamese logistically and with the monetary support that we had led them to believe they could count on, I believe they could have sustained themselves.
You do paint a rather mixed picture of the South Vietnamese forces, and in particular their military leadership, which was, a mixed bag, certainly. But you do paint a picture of President Thieu doing really admirable work in many respects, and of certain key South Vietnamese commanders, and of course of certain South Vietnamese soldiers who were demonstrated great valor. Just paint that picture a little more completely for us.
Well, you're right in everything you've just said. The picture was mixed. There's no doubt about that. I'll have to say the picture was mixed in terms of the American armed forces, too. But we had more resources to draw on. Eventually, the South Vietnamese built up their forces to 1.1 million people in uniform. And that's out of a population of, nobody knows exactly because the census data wasn't very good, but 15, 16, 17 million at most. So, you know, one out of 15 would be in uniform. If you translated that to the United States, maybe we had a population of 300 million, and one out of 15 would have been many millions of people in uniform. And we had a couple million, maybe 2.5 million, if you count all the services. And during the course of the war, because it was necessary to replace the forces we were withdrawing, we assisted South Vietnam in building up their forces, expanding them. And as I pointed out earlier, most of the expansion was in those territorial forces that were providing the hold and clear and hold. And so what leadership they had was getting spread more and more thinly, obviously. And, of course, they were taking significant losses also. And so that took some of their best leaders as well. No one would argue that every division commander they had was up to the job, or probably every squad leader either, but they were holding their own and more, because we know much less about the enemy, in part because it was a closed society and there was never any media attention to it of the kind focused on the South Vietnamese and our forces. But we know that they also had very serious problems of morale, problems of desertion, problems of sometimes inept leadership. And so, you know, it's not just that the South Vietnamese had these problems and the enemy did not. Many people feel that because in part of our influence and because they had gotten a stable government in place, that if a little more time had passed, let's call it half generation of better qualified leaders would have arisen one more level, let's say, in a hierarchy, and that some of those problems of leadership would have been much diminished. No one can argue that for sure, but that's the way it seems to look.
The peace accord, which is signed in Paris, which really sets in motion America's utter withdrawal from South Vietnam, was fatally flawed in your analysis and in the analysis of some on one particular point, and that is the presence of North Vietnamese armed forces in South Vietnam.
Yes.
Explain why this was such a crucial matter left unresolved and what its consequences ultimately were.
Well, the peace accords had, in theory, been being negotiated over a very long period of time. The meetings in Paris just dragged on for year after year, literally. And it wasn't until after the so-called Christmas bombing of 1972 when President Nixon got serious about using air power, which we had not been serious about before, air power in North Vietnam, that the genuine negotiations took place. And then by the end of January, I believe 27 January is the date of the signing of the so-called Paris Accords, an agreement was reached. And always up until then, one of our key negotiating points, which we held out for, had been mutual withdrawal of forces, foreign forces, from South Vietnam. So that meant that we and the other people who were there trying to help the South Vietnamese would withdraw, but also that the North Vietnamese would withdraw their forces. Now, this is a little tragicomic opera here, because the North Vietnamese had never admitted that they had any forces in South Vietnam, but of course they had many thousands there. And so we fell off on that negotiating point. I don't know why, but it appears that Mr. Nixon and probably primarily Henry Kissinger, who by now was Secretary of State, believed that if we didn't reach an agreement then, that the Congress was going to vote us out of the war, and so the Vietnamese would be abandoned by us totally. And so they're hoping to avert that. That's the best take I can make on that. So we fell off on the requirement that the North Vietnamese withdraw. This meant that when the peace agreements were signed and we left, as we had said we would, by the end of March 1973, we had withdrawn all of our forces there, as had the other nations that were contributing forces, the South Koreans in particular, the Thais, Australians, New Zealanders, a few from the Philippines. Now the South Vietnamese have to cope with this, you know, invading force, with the substantial forces still within their borders. Now, I have to say, they went about that with a will, and as long as we were supporting them fully in the ways I'd said, they were holding their own. And I don't know how long the fighting would have gone on. Who knows? It could still be going on today. But we, you know, once we pulled out the support that they needed, the logistical and monetary support, and the North Vietnamese were still getting greatly increased support, actually, from their backers, as you pointed out a little earlier, the outcome was no longer in doubt. Mm-hmm.
We're speaking with Lewis Sorley. We're talking about his book, A Better War, The Unexamined Victories and Final Tragedy of America's Last Years in Vietnam. Ahead of drawing some parallels with the present day, I want to give you an opportunity to address the concern that has been raised by certain analysts and critics, and I think we touched on this very briefly in our first interview, the fact that some are calling your book revisionist history, and that I think in some cases people are wondering if, first of all, you might be succumbing to the same optimism that perhaps General Abrams had, which was the same optimism that General Westmoreland had, that in fact there was a victory possible there that in fact was impossible right from the start. How would you respond to that concern which has been raised by some, that in fact the situation could not possibly have been as positive with so much potential for victory as you describe in your book?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you raised that, because that's obviously is a key point. As we may have discussed a little bit yesterday, most of the better-known books about the war focused almost entirely on the earlier years, the years when General Westmoreland was in command. The best-known one, perhaps Pulitzer Prize-winning, is Neil Sheehan's book, A Bright Shining Life, which is nominally a book about a man named John Paul Vann. Sheehan devotes 92% of his 790-page book to events through Tet 68, and only 8% to the whole rest of the war, which was 7 years more. And during four of those 7 years, John Paul Vann was still living and working in Vietnam. So why he abandoned the story at that point, I don't know. But because of that and other books like that, most Americans know a lot about the earlier years of the war in Vietnam, of our involvement, and they think that's the story. And, of course, I argue that my treatment of the later years is not revisionist history because that period has been ignored. So I'm saying this is new history. It's history that we have not previously had about that period of the war. Now, as to the optimism of General Abrams, I think you're going to be hard-pressed to find any examples of optimism on his part. When he became, even before he became the formal commander, he was in de facto command because General Westmoreland was off saying goodbye at various places and so on. And General Abrams dispatched a message to his senior commanders, and he said, henceforth, the public affairs policy of this command is going to be to let events speak for themselves. And he was not going around making optimistic pronouncements, and he didn't want anybody else to be doing that either. So the optimism that may have characterized the later period is based on events, and it's based on such things as, well, the macro example, I suppose, is what we've already discussed, is the outcome of the 1972 Easter Offensive. The enemy threw 20 division equivalents into a massive conventional attack of against the South, and the South Vietnamese bent and took a lot of casualties, and then they stiffened and they threw the invaders back with massive losses. And as I pointed out, so such that only 3 years later were they able to mount another significant offensive of that magnitude. And by then, we'd withdrawn our support. So I don't know if you want to call that optimism or not, but if you look at what happened on the battlefield, I do think it says that the South Vietnamese had made great strides in that period.
Hmm. As we think about the current conflict, both in Iraq and especially in Afghanistan, a couple of things really, I mean, I am anxious for you to know, for you to tell us to what extent you think close parallels should be drawn and what lessons there are to learn from the Vietnam conflict when we think about this present-day conflict. One of the things which comes to mind from your book is an exchange which occurs after a visit paid to Vietnam by Alexander Haig, then Brigadier General Alexander Haig, sent by Nixon's White House. And someone, I think, in commenting about his visit and some of what he conveyed to the leadership there, said there were essentially two messages delivered. One of them is, go get him, and the other was, hurry up and get out.
Yes.
Or maybe that question was posed to General Haig, that is, which is it, go get him or hurry up and get out?
Yep.
And in a sense, when we think about, for instance, what we are doing now in Afghanistan, there is probably that same rub in place.
Well, maybe. Let's dispose of General Haig rather quickly. I'm not an admirer of his, and I think almost everything that you'd see about him was tinged with self-interest. But you're right. He made a visit there, sent out there by Nixon and Kissinger on a fact-finding mission, and he did bring a very mixed message, which was not helpful at all to the commanders in the field. Now, you know, we could have an entire conversation and more about events of recent days and the president's speech at West Point and so on. Much of the commentary since then that I've seen, and I know you have too, focused on his statement that the duality, let's say, of his statement that he's sending 30,000 more troops and that he's going to begin a withdrawal in about 18 months. So people say, well, that seems to be working in competing directions.
Much as this scenario points out that I just quoted about General Haig and that exchange, a similar kind of duality.
Here's what I think about that, and I'm, you know, everybody has their own view of this, so I'm not insisting on this, but the way it looks to me is this. The president has gotten a new commander, General McChrystal, and he said, go out there and look at what the situation is and tell me what we need to do. And they've had these lengthy discussions, as you know, I think at least 9 major sessions over a period of many weeks, which I think has been a good thing. we discussed before, I believe, that this is a president with no military background or experience. And so I think that's probably been a good thing, that there have been lengthy discussions which will help him to come to grips with it, with what his responsibilities are and what his options are. And so they've said to the commander, okay, we're going to give you most of what you asked for, and you know, those numbers may not be even the most key thing, but he asked, apparently asked for 40,000. They're giving 30,000, and they've cranked up 5,000 more from some NATO sources. So that's pretty close to what he asked for. And then they said, and we're going to begin to withdraw forces by this date certain in 18 months or whatever it is. But they didn't say we're going to withdraw all our forces there. So I believe Secretary of Defense Gates said that the pace of the withdrawal and so on is going to be events-dominated. That may not be the exact term he used, but that's the sense of it. And I believe that they're keeping their options open, which if I were the commander in the field, I would say, good, that's good. If this thing can be moved along faster, then you can accelerate the pace of withdrawal. If it it's taking longer, we can moderate that pace. Just going back to the Vietnam experience, we've covered this, but the withdrawals began. Mr. Nixon was inaugurated in January of 1969, and the withdrawals began in July and August of that year, 25,000 in the first increment. That's out of a high water mark of 543,400 that we had there. So that's a modest first increment. Later that year, October, November, December, 40,500 more came out. But the fact is that the 543,000 plus were taken out in 14 increments over a period of 3 years, from the summer of 69 through the summer of 72. So that gave the Vietnamese the opportunity to develop their forces, to expand their forces, and we helped them to much better arm and equip those forces and train them, and they could progressively take over responsibility as our forces were withdrawn. So as I read it anyway, the president hasn't said, hey, on this date certain, I'm taking out all the forces there. He said, we will begin to withdraw our forces. And that could very well be analogous to that first increment that Mr. Nixon withdrew. And we don't know now what the pace of withdrawal will be or the magnitude of the withdrawals, but that's sort of what I expect to see happen.
Am I hearing correctly that you have fairly positive feelings about this move that is going to be made in Afghanistan?
Well, I do. I don't know General McChrystal, but he has a very fine reputation, and it's clear that working with the president and his senior civilian advisors on military forces and senior military officers as well, they have reached an agreement that this is a viable course of action. And the other side of the coin is, of course, determinative. We all know that. Will the Afghanis be up to playing their part in all of this? We can only do our part. And of course, we can do everything we can to persuade the Afghanis to do their part. And I'm not thinking just of their military forces or of their police forces, although they are critically important, but I'm thinking also of both their central government, which right now doesn't look very strong at all, and their local governments, which are permeated, as I understand it, by many tribal influences, which are not harmonious, but rather disparate. And so, you know, there are many uncertainties here and many difficulties to be overcome, but if that weren't the case, we wouldn't need to be there in the first place.
Hmm.
So how it all works out, you know, I don't wish to say that I am totally optimistic that we will achieve the desired outcome, but I do think it is important to remember that the president has said and emphasized that the reason we are there is because we see our security interests as necessitating our being there to reduce or, if possible, eliminate the base of support for terrorists who wish to do us in. That now exists there and in neighboring Pakistan.
That has been pointed out as an interesting, by some, as an interesting distinction between our conflict in Afghanistan, our reason for being there, and our reason for being in South Vietnam. That, in fact, we were not confronted by any sort of direct threat, and it was not the result of any sort of direct attack. that brought us to Vietnam versus what brings us into Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from that, do you think we are inclined to draw too many parallels between our conflict in Afghanistan and what occurred in Vietnam? I mean, or in fact, are they so similar that we really should view them that way and mm-hmm. and draw richly from the first experience and the lessons learned?
Well, you keep asking one key question after another. I have to compliment you for that. My view, which is not necessarily the authoritative one, but my view, having spent all this time looking at Vietnam, is that there are many similarities, but there are also many differences. And just in the context of what we're now discussing, I would mention that one difference, it seems to me, is that the South Vietnamese government, after President Chu came into office in 1967, was a much better government than the anti-war detractors ever gave it credit for, and deserves a better reputation than it has. And I think I say that to make the point that I think it was a better functioning, more capable government than the government in Afghanistan now seems to be. Certainly at the national level, that appears to me to be the case. I don't know exactly what the situation is with respect to the local governments, which are also extremely important. But when President Chu took office and pacification began to be greatly emphasized after Abrams took command of our forces, they went to great lengths to strengthen the local governments in the hamlets and villages of rural South Vietnam in particular. And I may have mentioned earlier that they ran, in 1 year, they ran three-quarters of the people involved in local government through a training center at which President Chu addressed each class and told them, how important their job was and sent them home, instructed to serve the people, if that was what they were supposed to do. And that was you could almost say that was a new insight, certainly a new mission for them. There are other differences. I haven't been to Afghanistan, but as we can see from the coverage of the situation there, the terrain is extremely difficult. And the terrain in Vietnam was difficult too, but in different ways. It was it was mostly jungle coastal lowlands, very hot and all that. I served up in this what we'll call the Central Highlands, which were pretty rugged terrain in some places, but not what I see in these portrayals of the mountainous regions of Afghanistan. I read in the press today someone saying that flying over that, they could see that the war in Afghanistan was going to be a valley-by-valley affair, and that seemed to make sense to me.
Well, of course, we are watching those events with utmost interest for all kinds of different reasons, and even as this conflict plays out, compels us to reflect back on what transpired in Vietnam and why. And of course, your book is a very important part of that conversation and reevaluation as we come to grips with what occurred and did not occur there, which in the words of Ambassador Bunker at one point was a bittersweet sense of what might have been.
Yes.
The book is A Better War, The Unexamined Victories and Final Tragedy of America's Last Years in Vietnam, a Harvest book now available in paperback from Harcourt and its author, Lewis Sorley. Lewis Sorley, once again, I thank you so much for writing this intriguing and important book and for joining me today on The Morning Show. I do appreciate this on a most sincere, profound level. Thank you again.
Thank you, sir. It's been a privilege.
This was a Morning Show interview that initially aired 10 years ago in the spring of 2007. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Jack Rose, co-president of the Kenosha County chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance for Mental Illness. The first week of October is Mental Illness Awareness Week. On Wednesday, Philip Stead, he is responsible, along with his very talented wife, for creating a new book called The Purloining of Prince Oleomargarine. It is a delightful children's book which springs from recently discovered notes by none other than Mark Twain, notes from a evening story time that he told to his daughters. And this book has just been published. And we talked to the author, Philip Stead, about it on Wednesday. Thursday, Anthony Barnhart, who is from the psychology science department at Carthage and also a professional magician, talking